Okay, so I see most of you have this book, so I'm assuming you have read it, read some of it, or part of it at least.
Yeah. Working on it.
Yes.
Okay. So. It's hard. Nothing is easy.
Yeah. I liked it. I thought it was actually easier for me than the sutras.
Yeah.
The sutras I had to like take breaks from. This one I can just kind of go.
Yeah, it's the concepts are hard, you know. I've been studying these both sutras and the Gita for almost 15, 20 years, almost. Mm-hmm. And you know, like one of my teachers used to say, you know, he says, okay, the guy came, he says, Swamiji, I've gone through this Gita many times, but I don't understand it. You know, I've gone through the Gita many times. He says, the question is not how many times you have gone through the Gita. Question is, has the Gita gone through you? Okay? It's a very difficult concept, you know. Gita has concepts which take so long to grasp and understand. Mm-hmm. And then it is not just understanding intellectually, it is applying them into your life. That's where the whole concept is, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with sutras. Mm-hmm. It's not just intellectually understanding them. Can you apply everything that you understand into your life, into your daily life? You know? That's where the problem is. If you understand it, when it comes to applying it, we'll see it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Let me enjoy my food right now. So let's go through it quickly. We don't have too much time. So I'm going to give you some background as to what kind of events led up to this war of Mahabharata. And there are these four paths of yoga, as you probably know, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga and Dhyana Yoga. Okay, so the four paths of yoga. And there's a lot of discussion on the three gunas that we mentioned in the sutras discussion. Bhagavad Gita is full of that guna discussion. And then I've picked a few verses in the Gita that I found interesting and I like them. I call them more significant verses and all that. Okay, so that's what we will do that quickly. Okay, so now, what's the background? Have you heard the term Ramayana and Mahabharata?
Mahabharata.
Don't call it Bharata, it's Mahabharata.
Mahabharata.
Yeah, okay, because if you mispronounce it, then it means nothing. Just like any other language, if you mispronounce it, it means nothing or something different. Okay,
yeah, okay.
So it's Mahabharata.
Mahabharata.
Right, not Bharata. Same thing, not asana, it's asana.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
Okay. You got it. Yeah. I got it. Yeah. Tickle a little bit.
Yeah, so because otherwise, you know, in Sanskrit they don't mean anything. So, what is Ramayana? Anybody heard the term Ramayana? No, okay. Again, these are two great stories in India, epic stories in India, you know. And you can make the statement that the entire fabric of Indian culture is based on the philosophies that are embedded in these two epics. Okay? All right.
When you say India, because there's a lot of different sects.
When I'm talking of India, I'm talking of the Hindu part of India.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I just wanted to clarify that.
Hindu part of India.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. India is a lot of Muslims and Christians and Jews and everything, you know, they're all there.
Right.
But I'm talking the Hindu part of India.
Right.
Yeah. But then, you know, because they all live there, you know, these values kind of creep into their culture also.
Right.
They do.
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
Even Muslims and Christians, you know, in India, they have some of these values which are very common in the Hindu context.
Mm-hmm. I can see a lot of themes when I'm looking across all of it. There's a lot of
universal truths.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
They're always there, right?
Yeah.
Nobody will say harm others. Nobody will say tell a lie. You know, these are all very common values. You know?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so Ramayana is another story which is very epic and again forms a very strong base in India. Mahabharata is, of course, as you all know, it's a story. In some parts it sounds and reads like a true soap opera. If you read the story, it has all kinds of characters, good characters, bad characters, ugly characters, handsome characters, and all kinds of schemes and plans of hurting people, revenge, anger, jealousy, everything is there. But the important part is that the underlying structure, which is very philosophical, that kind of brings out the entire philosophy of life. And like I said, the entire fabric of Indian culture is based on those philosophical content. Okay. And Bhagavad Gita is a part of that. It's a part of that whole soap operatic theme, basically. It comes out of that. And it is all beautiful. You know? But then, it's not just Bhagavad Gita. That's just one part of it. All through the Mahabharata, there are sprinkles of beautiful messages that you can pick up and love them. Okay? Yeah. All philosophical messages. Okay? So there are, it's a sub, many thousands of years old, nobody knows exactly how old, it's, every historian has their own view. Okay. And, you know, you have to understand this whole philosophy that's presented in the Gita is a summation of philosophies which are present in the old ancient texts called Vedas. Does everyone know what Vedas are? Okay, the ancient texts. There are four of them in number, and they are mentioned the names here. And they are the oldest volume of knowledge and wisdom, so to say. Okay. Again, they are considered in India, you know, they are revered as the most ancient texts. And they are called non-human texts. Apaurusheya is the Sanskrit word for that. What means... The claim is that these are the texts which came into the knowledge of these yogis who were in deepest states of meditation. So they were revealed to them in their states of meditation. They were not a result of their intellectual creation. They were pure revelations to them. Mm-hmm. That's what the claim is.
Okay. Just revelations or spiritually inspired?
Yeah, same thing, spiritual revelation.
Okay,
spiritual means they were in the deepest state of spiritual being, and that's when this revelation happened to them.
Okay.
That's how they claim.
Okay.
Okay. Vedas. And then they created, you know, some more, kind of put more meat around it, so to say. Okay, and then four Vedas. But then the last part of the Vedas is called Vedanta. Have anybody heard the term Vedanta?
Yeah.
Okay. So Vedanta is the philosophical part of the Vedas. It is also called the Upanishads. Anybody heard the term Upanishads?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you say that?
Upanishads.
Upanishads. Okay. Upanishads. I've been saying it wrong. Me too.
They're saying what?
I've been saying that one wrong.
Yeah.
What?
Upanishads.
Upanishad.
Yeah. That's how
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Again. It's just the way English is, you know, is written in English. So don't call it Upanishad or anything. It's Upanishad.
Upanishad.
Upa. Upa is the first prefix. Upa and Nishad.
Nishad.
Okay.
In general, it's Mahabharata.
Mahabharata. Right. Okay. So what it says is that Gita contains the very essential philosophical essence of these Upanishads, basically. Okay? And of course it has more. it adds a little more practical knowledge to it, you know, how to live life and all that. So all that is gets added into Gita. And Gita is one of the most revered texts in the Indian subcontinent. You know, if you go to a court, like in this country, I assume you have to take the Bible in your hand and you have to say oath. You know? Mm-hmm. In India, you have to take the Gita in your hand and then take the oath. Okay? That's how it is, how revered it is. All right. So it contains 18 chapters and there are 700 verses. All right. 700 total. Every chapter has different number of verses, right? Mm-hmm. Some are short, some are long. Now, it contains the teachings that were given by Lord Krishna to Arjuna. The Arjuna was who?
The warrior.
Warrior. Okay, so he was the warrior prince. And it's the message that Krishna gave to Arjuna. And I'll come to the background a little bit later. And Krishna was a king himself, as you all know, and he was a king himself. He had a huge, vast army of his own. But then it turned out that he was also a cousin of Arjuna, okay? But he was the kind of the reincarnation, so to say, of pure God, as they say. So it's God incarnated was Krishna, that's what they say, right? The message given in the Gita is pure wisdom. You know, it's total, you can say, a guide to life, basically. Okay? How to live your life. Same with the sutras. Everything is all the same, basically. Okay? Some of the concepts are common between the sutras and the Gita also. Many, many, many concepts are common. Okay? And, you know, these teachings were given to us when? Thousands of years ago. And they are just as relevant today as they were at that time. You know, maybe more so now.
Yeah.
We have more of those problems now.
We need them,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's written in a poetic form. And then when you recite the Gita, it's kind of chanted in that rhythm, in that poetic meter, okay? And there are 700 verses. In my assessment, about 80 to 85% of these verses are in one meter called Anushtubh Chanda, okay? And the others are in another meter called Trishtup Chanda. That's something. That's just how you recite them. Once you recite them, it becomes very beautiful. It becomes very meditative when you recite them in that continuous same manner. Okay. So just to give you a sample of how to recite, how the Gita is recited. Of course, many people have sung it in different ways. But the most common way to recite Gita is using this meter called the Anushtubh Chanda. And this is one of them. You know, I'm just going to recite this in Sanskrit. Okay. कर्मण्येवाधिकारस्ते मा फलेषु कदाचन मा कर्मफलहेतुर्भू मा ते संगोस्त्व कर्मणि. Okay, that's how it is. And you keep reciting every shloka in the same manner, and after some time, you know, it becomes very beautiful, meditative. You know, it's everything. So. And there are places where you go, like in the temple that where I teach, you know, where I study Gita, actually, not teach, I study Gita there. In the temple itself, they have every month or every twice a month or something, they do this chanting of Gita from beginning to end.
Wow.
Same beautiful manner.
Okay. How long does that take?
It takes about 3 hours. It's long. Yeah. Okay, so the meaning of this shloka, which is in chapter 2, is that, and this is one of the most important shlokas from the Gita, that you are entitled to do your duty action. We'll come to that as a part of Karma Yoga, okay, when we get there. I just wanted to give you a feel for how it is chanted, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These are the rules of this meter called Anushtup Chanda. Very precise rules. And the beauty of this Mahabharata is that this entire Mahabharata, 100,000 verses in Mahabharata, it's the longest poem ever written anywhere in the world. 100,000 verses. Okay? 90% of these 100,000 verses are in this meter. And each verse has to follow these rules very strictly. So you can imagine the caliber of these poets who can compose these verses. Every verse follows these rules. Okay, so the sixth syllable has to be long. I don't want to go into this, but very precise rules. You cannot violate these rules. Very beautiful. And that's the only way we could memorize them, and then. From oral tradition, you know, it came from generation to generation. Now, let's move on to this bit of an understanding of what caused this war in the first place, what led to the war. Do you have that background or no?
They talked a little bit in the
commentary.
Yeah, they talked about it a little bit in this.
But let's quickly go through this, okay? Because that's important.
Yeah.
It's important to get the background.
Yeah.
The rest of you can study on your own, but background is very important. Like I said, it's kind of a soap operatic story. It goes many generations before the war actually happened. But for our purposes, we can start with this concept where two brothers, Pandu and Dhritarashtra, okay, they were two brothers. So when their father died, okay, it had to be decided who is going to get the throne, right? Or kingdom. So normally the kingdom goes to the older brother, always, right? That's the tradition. But in this case, what happened was Dhritarashtra was blind. The older brother was blind. Okay, so legally, being blind, he could not be entrusted with the throne. Okay, so he was not given the kingdom. The kingdom was given to Pandu. Okay. Now, this Pandu, he ruled the country, his kingdom, for a long time. They say something like 25, 30 years. But then he got fed up. He said, I'm done with this. You know, all these kings, eventually they would go to a forest and lead a life of a sannyasa. That was the kind of the tradition in those days. They will rule the kingdom and finally proceed to the forest and live there rest of the life. Okay, so that's what happened. You know, Pandu, he said, okay, I'm finally going to go there to the forest, but then he didn't live too long after that. Okay, and then he had five children. Pandavas, they are called Pandu, so their sons are called Pandavas. Okay, that's the name of these five kids, you know, that he had, and these are the names given: Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula, and Sahadeva. Okay? And after Pandu died, these kids, they were very young. So Dhritarashtra, the blind king, he also had kids. Do you know how many kids he had? 100 sons and one daughter. So he had 101 kids. Okay? Say that again? Yeah, you have five brothers.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Five is enough. Yes. Actually, I have four. Miscounted. There were so many, I miscounted. Just kidding.
You have five siblings?
No, I have four. I miscounted.
You have the fifth.
Four that I grew up with, yeah. Yeah, I'm the fifth.
Yeah.
Okay. So Dhritarashtra, who was the blind king, eventually, you know, after Pandu died, he was given the kingdom in the interim, okay, so that while these kids are growing up, he will rule the kingdom, okay. So he did a pretty good job, they say, Dhritarashtra, for a short time. And then he took care of all the kids, basically. He took care in the sense that he was responsible for their training, for their education, for their learning, all the warfare learning and all that, you know, archery and fighting skills. You know, that's the warrior race, right? Kshatriya was the warrior race. Does everyone know what Kshatriya is? There are four, what do they call them? Four races, or four categories of people. Mm-hmm. What do we call them?
Castes.
Four castes in India. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does everyone kind of know that there's a caste system in India?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are four castes. They have a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. The highest is called the Brahmana, which is all the literary people, all the people who perform religious activities and functions, who are teachers and all that. You know? Okay. And then next is the Kshatriya, or the fighting, or the warrior caste. Okay. That's where Arjuna and all these are. Mm-hmm. All the kings, most of the kings were of the warrior class. The third is the Vanijya, or the Vaishya, called the trader class. The people who do business, you know, etc. Have shops and business and all that. And finally, the Shudra, or the last, was the
servants.
People who do service for others. Okay, all kinds of service. Okay. So these people, they were all in the warrior class, and that's why they needed all training which is suitable for warriors, which means archery and you know, weaponry, all kinds of weapons, all kinds of archery. And of course, then, because they were kings and princes, they needed to learn all the scriptures, so all the literature, scriptures, music, everything. So this was a very broad field of learning they had to go through. Okay. So this is the responsibility that the father had, you know, the Dhritarashtra. So he had very skilled teachers and all that. Okay. Now, among the Kauravas were the 100 brothers, right? They were called Kauravas. Okay, so who were the eldest among them? Duryodhana. Okay, so the eldest of the Kauravas was Duryodhana, and eldest of the Pandavas was
Yudhishthira.
Okay, he was the eldest. Okay. Okay. Arjuna was number 3 in their rank. So, this guy, Duryodhana, was the eldest among the Kauravas. And they all grew up together. Mm-hmm. Now, these guys, you know, in all fields of learning, apparently, these Pandavas, they excelled. Mm-hmm. They were excellent. Arjuna was absolutely the best archer ever. Dhritarashtra was, you know, a very strong guy, very intellectual, very powerful in his learning and everything. So he probably would make the best king ever. Okay. So because of their excellence in everything that they displayed, these Kauravas were a little bit jealous of them. So Duryodhana was very jealous. He was the eldest among the Kauravas, very jealous of the skills and the learning that they were displaying. So when they grew up, okay, when they grew up to become, you know, become princes and kings eventually, so Dhritarashtra decided, okay, let me have kind of a divided kingdom. Okay, so he kept the main kingdom that he was already on, and then gave a piece of land to these Pandavas to develop another kingdom. Okay. Barren land, there was nothing there altogether. Okay, so he said, okay, go and, because you are also entitled to kingdom, so just go and rule, make your own kingdom there. Alright, so these people, they went to that place and made it into a beautiful kingdom. So, and they were very successful, they were able to enlarge their kingdom by winning other areas and other properties and all that. So they become very prosperous in that barren land, eventually became a huge kingdom of their own. So now, that place was called Indraprastha, by the way, you know, that the name of it. And that Indraprastha is now called New Delhi or Delhi. That's the name of the town.
Yeah. That,
so these Pandavas, they developed that area, basically. Okay. And because these people were so successful, they were hope. The hope was that they will give them a barren piece of land and they will develop something there and just be happy there. But they developed into a beautiful kingdom. So Duryodhana was even more jealous now. He could not see them flourish and then become so powerful. Now, he tried his best to do harm to these people. At one time, the story goes that he even tried to kill Bhima. He gave them he actually tried to drown him in a river once, and he survived. Bhima was very powerful, so he was able to survive. He even poisoned him one time. Somehow he got out of it. Okay, etc. So, you know, they even sent them to some vacation spot at one time and created a whole palace there, which was made out of inflammable material. So the idea was that they will be having some kind of a party there, you know, invite other guests and all that, and then they will ignite fire to that house and everyone will be burned. So the story, the way it is written is, that somehow these Pandavas, while they were living there, they came to know that this was the plan. And they invited some guests and all that. But because they came to know of the plan, they actually dug up underground channel. What is it called?
Tunnel.
Sorry, my mind is blanked. Tunnel. They actually dug out a tunnel. They had, you know, some people dig out a tunnel for them so that they could escape from that tunnel. But before going through that tunnel, they themselves set this whole house to fire. And then they escaped through that tunnel. But unfortunately what happened was, the way it was, that there was some servant, maid servant, who was there with 5 kids of her own. Okay. And she was kind of trapped in that fire and they died. Now, these people escaped. All right? The story becomes very interesting because then people found out this whole house was burnt. Duryodhana came there, you know, and they found the bones of 6 people there, 1 woman and 5 kids. So they assumed that these people are dead, celebrated their death. Okay? These people escaped, went into a forest, lived for some time in the forest in the garb of some other people, became servants of somebody and then served there and all that. So this story, it's a very interesting story. I hope it's okay. I'm going to spend time, 5 minutes, just 5 minutes, I'll finish that story. So the story goes that, you know, while they were living in that forest, quite unknown to anybody, in the form of servants and all that, they were serving other people. Some king in the neighborhood, you know, they used to have these ceremonies where the women get married only by, they had to invite some princes and all that, all right? So the princess would be married off in a ceremony where other princes would come and they would be asked to fulfill some condition, and the one who does the best, that person would be married to the woman, to the princess. So there was a contest going on there, and in this, the king here, he had a very lovely princess daughter, and he created a contest which says that at the top of a pole there was a kind of a fish, you know, rotating fish, you know, symbol of rotating fish, okay, that rotating at a speed, top of a pole. And at the bottom of that pole there was a little small pond of water, small tub of water. So the goal was that whoever these princes were supposed to look at that water, pick up the bow and arrow, and shoot 5 arrows, and looking at the image of that. So you're not looking up, but looking at that, but pointing at that fish, and you had to pierce the eye of that fish with that arrow, looking here. Okay, so everyone tried, everyone failed, obviously. You know. And all the princes who came, they all failed. And this guy, Arjuna, you know, he happened to be their servant. He says, can I try? He was the best archer in the country anyway. So nobody expected him to do anything, but obviously he succeeded. Okay, looking at this, he was able to pierce the eye of this fish with all the 5 arrows. So now, you know, they had to marry off that girl with this Arjuna. Okay. So they went home. Their mother was there in the house. So they said, hey, look, mother, what we got. Look, mother, what we got. They brought the wife along. Mother from there, he says, what would they normally bring? They normally would bring food from the other people, right? So he says, it doesn't matter what you have, share it among yourself. Okay, so he says, share it, you know. So he brought the girl along. He says, this is what we have. Now I have said that, so you have to share it among yourselves. So she became the common wife of all these 5 princes. You might have heard that. So they all had the same wife. Okay, that's how the story goes. Okay. In any case, once this whole thing happened, then it came to light that these are the actual princes and all that, you know, it became known. So then they were given then they were asked to go back to their kingdom. But now Duryodhana said, nothing doing. I am not going to give you anything back, no matter what. I'm not going to give you even the amount of land which is occupied by the needle, you know, the pin of, you know, the edge of the needle. Okay, I'm not going to give you anything. And then Krishna got involved. He was sent as a messenger to find some way to give them some piece of land. He said, okay, if nothing else, give them 5 villages, 1 for each prince. He said, nothing doing. I'm not going to give you anything. I'm happy the way I am. That's it. You're done. So that's where this whole thing started. All right. So, you know, in the meantime, there was this whole match of, you know, this gambling match that was organized by Duryodhana. In those days, it was considered to be a duty for the other kings or princes to accept gambling matches. It was a common practice. Okay, so they invited him, so they went there. Now, through trickery, you know, this Duryodhana has an uncle who was very good at modifying the dice in the game. Whatever happened, so they started winning, the Kauravas. Pandavas started losing. And eventually, Yudhishthira, you know, the main guy, he was the main person there. They lost everything in that whole process, completely everything. Everything including what? Their kingdom, their wealth, even their wife. They lost their wife. Did you remember?
Have you? I remember reading this.
Okay, they lost their wife also. And then there was a condition that if you lost, you have to go to a forest and live there for 13 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And they try to do all kinds of things. They try to insult that woman by disrobing her in public and all that. All these things happen. Finally, 13 years of exile into a forest. And how were those 13 years to be spent? 12 years in exile, as they are. And then last year, the 13th year, incognito. That means nobody should be able to recognize who they are. They have to change their shapes or whatever, garbs or whatever, and then become somebody else, etc., etc. Okay? And so they did all that, you know. In the 13th year, again, a lot of stories are there, how they spent the 13th year. And, you know. Finally, when everything was done, they came back and demanded their kingdom back. So that was the condition. But that's when Duryodhana said, nothing doing, I'm not going to give you anything back. After having ruled for 13 years, he was, you know, he was really powerful and he had the taste of kingdom. He didn't want to get rid of it now. So that's where the whole concept of war took, you know, that the idea of war took place, because this was evil thing going on. As Krishna said, they are evil. They are not keeping their promise. So war took place, basically. So that's the background of how the war took place. And Krishna offered to support both these sides. He had a big army. So Arjuna, he asked Arjuna first, what do you want? Do you want me or my army? He says, I want you. I don't want your army. Duryodhana was very happy. He says, okay, I'll take your army. Because he was more for power and army. And Arjuna knew that this guy is the Supreme Consciousness. So I just want him by my side. It'll help me. All right. And then he also requested him to become the charioteer, Krishna, to become his chariot driver, basically. All right. So this is how the whole thing started out. Okay. And I have a certain few quotes from some renowned thinkers about Gita and all that. You can read them. So now, you know, battleground is all set. All the armies are set, and there's a central line, kind of the neutral line, and then on one side one army, on the other side the other army. And now Krishna, you know, he is the chariot driver, charioteer. So Arjuna says, please take this chariot to the center of the battlefield, so that I can review the enemies as they are, how they are lined up and all that. So this guy takes him where, you know, on the other side all his teachers and everybody was there. So the way it was, because for 13 years Duryodhana ruled the whole country, so all the people who were teachers, who were their uncles, aunts, you know, and then everybody who were their elders, they all sided with the king. That's the rule. That's the law of the land, that you have to side with the king, because he is the provider of your livelihood. Okay? So everybody who gave them any kind of knowledge, you know, they were teachers, Kripa, and, you know, all these people are Acharya, they call. Acharya means the super teacher, supreme teacher. And Arjuna saw all of them there on the other side, right? The teachers who had given him everything, every single bit of knowledge that he had, whether it's archery, whether it's literature, everything. Plus his uncles, his aunts, his cousins, his brothers, everybody, he saw them there. Okay? And the moment he saw that, he said, how can I fight with these people? How can I kill any of them? You know, they are my people, they are my elders, my respected folks that I have lived all my life, learned from them, and now I want to kill them? No way. I'm not going to do that. You know, this is, you know, if I kill all these people, I will create so many thousands of women who are, you know, deprived of their husbands and all that. So he says, I don't want to fight. Okay? So with thousands of widows in the society, it will be chaotic. The society become chaotic, and I have no desire to fight. I'd rather become a sannyasi. I'd rather go to a forest and live as a sannyasi, he says. Much better. Or I'll get, you know, I don't even mind losing my life, but I cannot kill these people. So he just lays down his all the arms, sits at the base of the chariot. I'm done. So that is where Krishna gives him this message now called Bhagavad Gita. Okay, that's the whole background and the story. So this is where the concept of Bhagavad Gita took place, because he gives him the message that, look, you belong to the warrior race. You have the warrior blood in you. And this is a situation which demands that war take place, because these people are evil and they are not doing the things that they should be doing. They're doing wrong things. And the only way to set some kind of balance in the society is to kill these people. You have to fight. Okay? So when you study Gita, you know, when I started studying Gita, this was a big question. I was a very strong person in favor of no war, you know. I never liked wars. You know. And now here I am told that war is absolutely a must.
This has been the hardest part for me to understand.
Okay, so this is the hard part for everybody, and I went through that whole thing, you know. How can you promote this war where thousands of people die? Thousands of people. Blood all over the place. And yet you're saying that, go ahead and do it.
How can you justify that?
Okay, so that's the hardest part to understand. But then once you start reading it, once you start understanding it, you become to understand the justification. Okay? All right? So that's the whole concept of Gita. And then there is a symbolism here, you know, which is also the same symbolism in one of the Upanishads, exactly. The body is the chariot itself, the five horses are the five sense organs, okay? Tongue, eyes, ears, and nose, and skin. The reins, you know, that control the horses, these are the driving instrument, that's the mind itself. So the mind is controlling the five senses, or supposed to, okay? And the passenger in the chariot is the Arjuna, which is the ego, which is completely under the ignorance, knowledge, avidya, doesn't know what to do. That's the chariot, that's the passenger, and body is the chariot. And the Krishna is the pure consciousness, the pure, so to say, the intuitive wisdom that we are looking for. He is the one who is driving this wisdom. And this war is basically the war of conflicts that we have, inner conflicts, good and bad, okay? So all the negative and positive tendencies, we constantly have this war. You know, some people call it the upper mind and the lower mind, constantly. You know, whether I should do this, I should do that. You know, go there, go not go there, etc. Conflict. So this is symbolism. So there are books on Gita, commentaries on Gita, which say this war is not something that actually took place. It's war that took place in the mind.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. That's what I was just wondering. I wanted to ask you that.
It's very symbolic in some sense. Of course, there are. Now people are trying to prove, you know, that they actually took place, and there are historical places and things that happened which can be seen and shown. So all these things are there. But there are commentaries of Gita. For example, there is a commentary by Yogananda. Have you heard the name Yogananda?
Yes.
Who's that?
I can't remember.
Okay. Yes. There's a book by the title Autobiography of a Yogi, okay, by Yogananda. He has given a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And in that commentary, he claims that, you know, this is all symbolic of the human being, okay, in the entire commentary. Okay? That's what he claims. Okay? So he refuses to fight, and then, so what's the main message here? This is something that I have kind of pulled together myself, you know, in my own understanding. This is the main message of the Gita, that you want to actively resist evil. That's exactly the message that Krishna gave to Arjuna. You want to resist evil. And know that you are the eternal spiritual self. And everything else is transient. This whole material being is transient. Body, mind, everything is transient. Comes and goes. And then stabilize the mind by overcoming desires. Okay? That's attachment. Desires bring attachment. So non-attachment is the main concept here. Stabilize the mind by becoming completely non-attached. And do your duty with non-attachment as sacrificial offering. Okay? Aspire to become, the term used in the Gita in chapter 2 is sthita prajna. Okay? That's the Sanskrit phrase for a person who is completely established in divine wisdom. Okay? Established, you know, firmly established in the divine wisdom. Okay? That's called sthita prajna. And the renunciation is the doership. Okay, we'll talk about that. That means, what you have to understand is, I am not the doer. Because I am the pure soul, I am the pure consciousness. Pure consciousness does nothing. It just observes, it's the seer. That's why the term seer was used there. Okay, but who's doing the things? Again, in chapter 3 it tells, everything is done based on the gunas. The gunas are responsible, the three gunas. Remember we talked about the three gunas? They are the ones which impel us or compel us to do things, and that's what is causing all the action that we do. Action in terms of physical action or mental action, it doesn't matter. Okay? But I'm not the doer. So you have to renounce that doership. Understand that concept. Okay? And then presence of God should be understood, acknowledged in everything that you do, feel, see, touch, everything. And then surrender to God with devotion. That's the same message that Patanjali had in Yoga Sutra. Surrender to God with devotion. Okay? And then know the truth about the three gunas, because that's what is very important in the Gita. Okay? So there are four major paths of yoga which are given in the Bhagavad Gita. Four paths. Has everyone kind of understood that concept? Right? What is Karma Yoga?
Yoga of action.
Okay, and we'll come to this. A few again. What I have picked is a few representative verses that go with each of these. You know, it's my pick. Okay, everyone can have a different pick. All right. So this is what I have picked. Jnana Yoga is yoga of knowledge. Bhakti is the yoga of devotion. And Dhyana is yoga of meditation. Okay, everyone kind of knows that. All right. So, like I said, these are the verses that I picked based on my study of the Gita. All right? And there are many verses that have the same theme, similar theme, but, you know, like I said, I picked these as representing Karma Yoga. Okay? So, very quickly, you know, just go through the concept of Karma Yoga. The basic concept of Karma Yoga is that you are only supposed to, or you're only required to do your duty. Okay, do your duty with the full devotion to what you're doing. Okay, the number 47 is the most important. That's what we said. You know, that's the most important shloka, most important verse. Your choice is in action only, not in the results thereof. You cannot be the architect of the results of your action. You're not. Therefore, give up any desire for the outcome of what you do. All right? But at the same time, just because you're giving up desire for your action, don't become inactive. You have to still keep doing work. But do it with the full intention that you're doing your duty. Right? Not because of you're expecting something. No expectation should be there. You know, when you go to India and then you know, many places, if you go to a temple or even an office building or a school or anything, okay, you will see this inscription on the walls of that building. This is one of the famous verses there. You know, it's inscribed almost everywhere. So that's the whole concept of karma yoga, that you have to devote yourself to your action, and to do that you have to be very skillful. So you have to develop full skills as to how you want to do your action. If you're not skilled, you will not be doing your action properly. So develop skills. And once you're skilled in what you're doing and you do that action without any expectation of any kind of return, then you're doing yoga. And that's the definition of yoga given in the Gita. Okay? At some point, all right? That you have understood you're skilled in what you're doing, and you're doing it with full intention to do it absolutely with the utmost depth, devotion, and then do it without any expectation. Okay, so, and then what you get out of that, treating pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat alike, very, difficult concepts. You know, whatever we do, we always have something in mind. What is in it? What's in it for me, right? We always ask this question. What's in it for me? Gita says just the opposite. Never ask that question. Never ask the question, what's in it for me? Whether it applies to your work, your family, your profession, doesn't matter. So, when you start reading Gita, these are the obstacles that you have to face, When I started reading Gita, how am I going to, for pleasure and pain, how can I treat them equally? Gain and loss, right? Honor and dishonor. Hardest, honor and dishonor. Somebody says, you are a stupid person, I'm going to get mad, I'm going to get angry. So, very difficult concepts. But that's what he says. Krishna says, completely become non-dual in that sense. Okay? So it says, do your duty to the best of your ability with your mind attached to the Lord. You're only attached to the Lord, nothing else. There's no other attachment in your mind. Ishvara, God, that's what he says. And in the Gita, Krishna says, I am that. Krishna says, I am that Ishvara, I am that Lord that you should be attached to, nothing else. Because I represent that God. Okay? So everything he says is oriented towards me, not away from me. And then you remain calm in both success and failure. Very difficult. Very difficult concept. Okay? And then he says, when your mind is completely even, evenness of the mind, that's one of the definitions of yoga, is evenness of the mind is called yoga. When the mind is completely calm, that's what Patanjali says, chitta vritti nirodha. That means, calm the mind to a point there is no disturbance, there is no fluctuations in the mind. And that, and Lord Krishna says, that's called evenness of the mind. And that's yoga. Same definition, basically, as Patanjali says. So therefore, without being attached to the fruits of your activities, then you do your work as duty. Okay? And then you can attain the Supreme Being. Then you can attain the Supreme Consciousness. Okay? Alright. So these are some of the concepts of Karma Yoga mentioned here. And again, in the chapter 327, what it says, actions arise from the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. The knower of the gunas knows that all actions are caused by the triple modes of nature, these gunas, and only the ignorant thinks that I am the doer. So that's the renunciation of the doership. That's a very common theme. You will see that in many different verses in the Gita, in different ways put together, that do not attach yourself to the outcome of your actions. That's the ultimate non-attachment. Okay. And then desire and anger, you know, we all know that. What is anger? How does that anger happen? We have some desire and it's unfulfilled and we get angry. Okay. So when there are passions, when there are desires which are insatiable, and then we get angry, and they are enemies. That's what it says. The anger is one of the strongest enemies of our mind, of our being, right? And there's another verse here somewhere. I probably have given it later somewhere about anger. It's called Ladder of Destruction.
Ladder of Destruction.
Ladder of Destruction. Anger. I'll come to that. Okay. So that's Karma Yoga. What's Jnana Yoga now? What is the yoga of knowledge? What do you understand by that? No, Jnana Yoga is... No, what is the concept there? Study of text for what purpose? What are you trying to understand?
Wisdom.
Basically, the concept of Jnana Yoga is that I am nothing but the pure soul. That's the knowledge you want to gain, ultimate knowledge. That I am pure consciousness, pure soul, not this body-mind complex. Right? That's the ultimate goal of this understanding, jnana, knowledge, wisdom. That's the ultimate wisdom, that now I know that I am the pure soul and not this mind-body. Because until that happens, my soul is tied up with my ego. Okay? And ego is a conglomerate of all these memories and impressions and everything. Yeah. So, why am I in this cycle of birth, rebirth, death and all that? Why? Because my soul is entangled with this whole complex of mind, body and memories. Okay? It's not free. So when my physical body disappears, physical body dies, I am merged with the five elements. What are the five elements? Earth, water, air, fire, and ether, right? Five elements. So, my physical body merges back with those five elements. Okay, but what goes into the next human body?
Spirit.
That spirit which is entangled with this ego and full of memories and impressions and likes and dislikes and all that. That whole conglomerate goes into the next body, and it gets attached to the next human physical body and makes the next human birth, basically. That's why we are in this whole cycle of birth and rebirth and all the death, because my soul is not independent, it's not free, it's not free of that bondage. So that's the whole purpose of Jnana Yoga, which is similar to the concept in Patanjali Yoga Sutra, conceptually. Very identical. Okay? And then he gives it, this is also a very well-known shloka, number 22. Just as a person puts on new garments after discarding old ones, the individual soul acquires new bodies after casting away the old bodies. Okay? That's just a way of explaining how this whole reincarnation happens. Okay? And, you know, then it gives this wording of nine gated, the human body is said to be nine gated city. So there are nine gates, nine openings. What are the nine openings here? Two ears, two eyes, two nostrils,
mouth.
That's seven. Procreation and elimination. Nine. Okay? So this body is, in the Gita it says it's a nine-gated city. Navadwara in Sanskrit. So what it says is there's this embedded soul. Embedded because this soul is still attached to my mind, body, and my ego, etc. So it's called embedded soul. It's the indweller of the physical body. Now, once you renounce all actions mentally, and then you understand the concept of non-doership, then you become totally free of actions. That's the whole concept. Okay? It's Jnana Yoga. Now, death is certain, it says, you know, this is one of the very strong arguments Krishna gives, that why you should engage in fight, in war. Because if you're born, you're going to die. If you die, you're going to be reborn. So that means death is certain for these people in any case. Okay, they're all going to die. But they should be killed now because they are right now causing problems. They'll be reborn in any case afterwards. So no problem. But they should be killed now. And in some statement, Krishna says, I know that they already have been killed by me, but they are here only because they want to live a physical life. Something like that. Very strange. Okay? So that's the whole concept of Jnana Yoga, wisdom, yoga of knowledge, that this death is certain, rebirth is certain. And by killing these people, you're going to do no harm. You're just going to bring them to their ultimate reality anyway. But they deserve to die now. Their bodies and their minds deserve to be killed now because they are doing evil stuff now, at this moment. That's the justification of this war. Okay?
So the concept of reincarnation kind of made me understand a little bit. And I wanted to ask you if this makes sense or not. This is what it was intended. Because when I start reading, when I got to the part of like trying to justify the
war.
So I believe in reincarnation. I studied spiritism. I studied reincarnation. I believe in all that. And I believe that we reincarnate in order to evolve and progress our spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And we come with the body that we need to come with. Mm-hmm. We come with the people that we need to, like you said, like to learn the lessons that we need to learn and work on for this lifetime. And then we learn that, we have, once we are incarnated, we have the labels of my family, my parents, we still need that because our spirit's not evolved enough, so we need those labels. But once we evolve and we progress, we detach from those labels and we learn that we're all one, that there's no difference among us, that the soul and the spirit is all equal and all the same. So then, to me, the way to kind of justify that was that, so even though in this scenario all the others are relatives and friends and people that he knew and that he kind of had as like a family ties or loving ties, they are just, like spirits that are not well evolved and are still promoting
That's the right understanding. That's exactly what he's saying, basically. Yeah. Very true.
But it's still hard to...
It is hard to... It took me so long to, I started out being extremely anti-war. You know, I never liked any of these wars, so this was very hard for me to kind of grasp. Some of the arguments are still kind of... I'm hazy. Right.
For you to kind of come back and deal with the next
week. Future karma, yeah?
You're helping them in a way, but you're also
making bad karma for you.
Maybe it generates
good. Yeah, that's the hardest thing.
It's hard.
So the killing and the war, you're generating bad karma.
Something to really think about deeply.
Yeah. Yes,
Okay, so now let me look at the time. It's 12:30 now. This is when we are actually supposed to stop. How are we with time? Can I take 10 more minutes and just wrap up, or you have to go somewhere?
Yeah.
No. Is that okay? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Because you know, it's so hard to compress everything in, right. In such a short time. You know,
during the break we said that we would like to kind of keep studying throughout the week with you to learn more about the
two books. That's okay. All right. So, so you can read some of these statements that I have picked. You know, it's very interesting. And you know, there are people who actually give talks on these sutras, these shlokas, and they take, you know, on a given day they'll take one or two shlokas and spend the entire day. You know,
yeah, I believe that.
You know, everything. You know. And this course that we are studying, it's a book, and this was a 3-year course by a Swami, 3 years residential course, every day 8 hours of Bhagavad Gita for 3 years.
Wow. Okay. You're doing that right now?
No, it's then they converted it into a book and we are studying that book.
Oh, okay. Whoa.
And we did that book a long time ago. It took us 9 years to finish that book.
Wow.
So we're doing it again now.
Wow.
Same thing we did with the sutras. It took us 10 years to finish the sutras book. Mm-hmm. Okay. So bhakti yoga, it's this yoga of devotion now. You know, yoga of devotion means that you are now kind of separating yourself from the supreme being, from the Ishvara or from the God. Okay, and then you are developing that sense of devotion, surrender, so to say, that I am surrendering myself, my ego, to this higher being. Okay, so what Krishna says that you have to devote yourself to me. So he says, I am the supreme being, I am the Ishvara, I am the God, and you have to have full 100% devotion to me. Okay, and then he talks about four different types of people who worship or seek him. One, they are the people who are either distressed, they've had some death in the family, or they have some loss. They go to God for help. Okay, then the people who are seekers of knowledge, who really want to understand who I am, etc. And then there are people who just want material wealth. Okay, so they are the other people. And then there are people who have gone through this process of self-learning, etc. And they have reached a very high level of spiritual elevation. And they also come to me for final merging with me eventually. So the four types of categories of people who are doing bhakti basically. And I personally take care of all the spiritual and material welfare of all those people who are very lovingly devoted to me. That's what he says. Okay, so please, he says, adore, you know, become, you know, my devotees basically. Full-heartedness, all wholeheartedness. And he even says, whoever offers me a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or a water with devotion, I accept the offering by the pure-hearted. Okay, so whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, whatever you give away, is all, do it as an offering to me. So that's see, this is where combination of karma yoga and bhakti yoga happens. It's a joint kind of a thing. Karma yoga says do your duty. Bhakti yoga says do your duty with a sense of devotion. Why are you doing it? Because you are devoting it to the God. Then when you do the action, results come back. Okay? Offer those results back to Ishvara. Don't take it that, oh, I did this, so I am the president, I am the vice president, you know, because I did this, then that. Nothing of that. You become the vice president, but offer that to God back. You know, this is all because of you. I did this as an instrument of you, as your instrument of action, and I'm offering myself back to you now. Okay? That's the sense of devotion that they are talking about. Okay. And then again, you know, very difficult to put into practice. One who remains the same toward friend or foe, in honor or disgrace, heat and cold, pleasure and pain, free from attachment, who is indifferent to censure and praise, who is quiet and content with whatever he has, unattached to a place, country or a house, tranquil, full of devotion, very difficult. Every one of these concepts is very tough. You go into detail and try to apply these into your life. Oh my God, how am I going to do that? You know, it's very difficult. Okay, mind. Now this is Dhyana Yoga, meditation. This is Patanjali's basically concept of Yoga Sutra that he is talking about here. Okay, so one must elevate and not degrade oneself by the mind. The mind alone is one's friend as well as one's foe. So friend and foe is all in the mind. It's all in the mind, as they say. And therefore you have to calm and control the mind. And then he says, be in the middle of the road, as they say. This yoga is not for one who eats too much or who doesn't eat at all, or one who sleeps too much or too little. You know, so middle road. Okay. So wherever this restless and unsteady mind wanders during meditation, and he's talking about meditation in the 6th chapter of Gita, and then he says one should just witness it under the supervision and control of the pure self. So kind of gives a brief guideline on how to meditate there. Okay? And he also says that sit up straight. It says in the Gita, you know, you have to sit up straight with the spine upright and all right, comfortable position, and then focus on me, basically. That's meditation. Okay. So this is a very important sutra, number 35 in chapter 6. Undoubtedly, the mind is restless and difficult to restrain, but it is subdued by constant and vigorous spiritual practice and detachment. Abhyasa and Vairagya, exactly the same words used here which Patanjali uses. 114. The words used are the same also. Gita also uses the same two words, Abhyasa and Vairagya in Sanskrit. Okay.
With the 635?
Yes.
Yeah, same
words. Same words at 114.
Do it for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, these are a couple of statements in the Gita which are considered the definition of yoga. So, he who looks upon opposites are equal, who has risen above duality and thus freed himself from both vice and virtue, is a yogi. And work done to perfection is yoga. That's where I mentioned the word skill. You can do the work to perfection only when you have all the skills needed to do that work. So you have to become very skillful in your job. No matter what you're doing, you know, learn the highest level of skill. That's the only time you can execute your work. Okay. And be even tempered in both success and failure. So equanimity is yoga. That's evenness. Okay? Evenness or equanimity is yoga. Okay? And yoga is known as the disconnection of the connection with suffering. So when right now we are connected with suffering, right? Through kleshas. Remember in the sutras we said kleshas. So we are now connected, we have a deep connection with suffering. When you disconnect from that connection, that's yoga. So that's why it says disconnection from the connection with suffering. Now, like I said, there is a large segment of Gita which is devoted to the description and discussion of the three gunas. All right, we don't have time for that now. But three gunas: sattva, rajas, and tamas. And Gita gives you a very nice long description. You can have. You know, the gunas can be applied to your mind, they can be applied to your job, they can be applied to your work, food, your thoughts, everything. So your thoughts could be sattvic, rajasic or tamasic. Your food is the same. Okay.
Sattvic
fire diet and rajasic diet, and you probably have heard these terms, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So everything, like I said, everything in prakriti, everything in this material complex is a combination of these three gunas. That includes our thoughts, our feelings and emotions, our activities. Even he talks about even giving charity, for example. You can give charity with sattvic mind, rajasic mind or tamasic mind. You can give charity so that your name appears on the top of the list. Okay, that's rajasic. Sattvic is when you have you give totally anonymously. You don't want anything to be mentioned about your name. But you're giving something for a good cause. So it talks about also, you know, when you give charity, you have to give to a person who is deserving of that charity. So you have to understand that. That's sattvic. Non-deserving, rajasic or tamasic, etc. Lots of things. So this is all given in the Gita. And it's a very strong component of both Gita as well as the Yoga Sutras. So the concept of gunas, please spend extra time, understand that concept. And because in the sutras also it's the same thing. Okay. So one who has transcended the gunas, remember in the Yoga Sutras also we said the same thing. One who has transcended the gunas is alike in pleasure and pain, remains the same toward a piece of gold, a lump of clay, a desirable and undesirable things, and equal in defamation and self-adulation. You can do only that level of detachment if you have transcended the three gunas. Okay? This is, you know, what I have mentioned here. In my understanding, after I've studying all for all these years, why we think the war is justified, okay? So these are my thoughts. So the preconditions for engaging in battle are, you know, you should develop equanimity towards pleasure and pain, loss and gain, victory and defeat. No matter what happens, you should be very balanced in your approach, totally. Unaffected, absolutely. So if you win the war, don't go and celebrate. Lose the war, don't get miserable. Okay? This is the kind of thing. Again, very difficult. Now, here, I have not mentioned that, but in my understanding, the war is justified because it is coming from who? The guidance is coming from God Himself. Okay? He is the guide, okay? God Himself, Krishna. And He has the purest mind. He has transcended all the negative tendencies of the human mind. That's why He is God. And therefore, He understands exactly what is good and bad, what is right and wrong, what should be done and what should not be done. And because it is coming from Him, it is justified, in one sense. But then the other reasons are, you should surrender all the acts to Him. In the case of, you know, God, for example, renunciation, right? Renounce all the outcome of your actions to Him, to God. So whether you lose or win, give it to Him. Okay? Should have His mind dwelling in the pure spiritual self. So only when you are completely pure and you are totally, you know, clarified in your mind, then only you should fight. Free of any expectations, free of the common obsession of mine and me, void of all feverishness from the being, and then engage in battle. Okay? You know, there was a story I was reading in the Buddhist context. So there are two, there's a battle going on, and then two warriors, you know, they finally engaged in hand-to-hand battle, you know, personal battle. You know, so one guy, he has a dagger in his hand and he's able to subdue his enemy. So the enemy is on the floor, and this guy has his foot on his chest, okay, subduing him, and he has raised his dagger to strike on him. Okay, the moment he raises his dagger, this guy who's on the ground, he spits on his face. On this killer's face, spits on his face, his hand stops there, right there. Okay, he doesn't want to strike now. Now this guy is in pain; he suffers. He says, "Kill me!" He says, "You have already. I'm in your control. Kill me! I'm suffering. Just kill me." This guy says, "No, I can't kill you now. Why? Why can't you kill me?" He says, "Because you spat on me. My ego is involved now." Earlier, I was doing my duty as a warrior. My pure intellect was involved. No ego was involved. Now you have made me angry. And if I do it now, I'll be a murderer. I'm doing out of anger, so I'll be murdering you. Whereas otherwise I was going to kill you because it was my duty to kill you. So, you know, that kind of brings out how, you know, this ego takes over, and then he says, I'm not going to kill you until my anger goes away.
Right.
It was a Buddhist kind of a story I read somewhere. Yeah, very nice story. Okay. And there are, you know, I have, like I said, you know, once you read the Gita, there are many, many shlokas, many verses which are very important, lot of meaning and deep understanding. So I have listed a few of those. Please go through them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I call them significant verses. I could not put them under any of those categories of karma yoga and all that, but they are very meaningful. This is what I was talking about, the ladder of destruction, which is all about anger. So one develops attachment to sense objects by thinking about sense objects. Desire for those objects comes from attachment to these objects. And anger comes from unfulfilled desires. You become angry. And then delusion or wild ideas arise from anger. The mind is bewildered by delusion. Reasoning is destroyed when the mind is bewildered. And finally, one completely destroys himself when reasoning is destroyed. So this is kind of the ladder of destruction, which is listed in these two sutras, two shlokas. They are very often quoted shlokas, very frequently quoted. Okay, so I just looked at some modern application. There is a book titled Bhagavad Gita on Effective Leadership, Timeless Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I have not read that book, but I read a review of that book, and it praised that book very highly. So I, you know, just put it here. And there was an article few years ago in the Business Week, Karma Capitalism. I read that. It was a very nice article. Okay. And how the Bhagavad Gita replaced the art of war as the new ancient Eastern management text. Okay. And there's another article by Bhagavad Gita and Management, nicely written. And this guy, we met this guy, Satish Modh. We met him. He is in India. He runs a business. And his business is all based on the three gunas. So what he does is, he does counseling. People at all levels. He does counseling for students, counseling for people who are in business, counseling for people who are in corporate world, and he counsels them. So students, he will counsel them as to what kind of studies they should be engaged in. How does he do it? He gives them a questionnaire. So if you go to that trigunayoga.com, you can see that questionnaire. You probably have to pay some money or something to do. I don't remember that now. But I did that questionnaire once. And based on the answers you give, he will determine which of your gunas is more dominant, whether it's sattva guna, rajas or tamas. Okay? Because that will determine what profession you should go to, okay, what kind of studies you should do, what kind of work you should do and all that. So that's what the counseling he does. And apparently he's doing very well. It's all guna based. Okay, so that's my last slide. Any last questions, thoughts, comments, feedback?
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was awesome.
Yeah.
It's really helpful.
Good. Thank you very much for being patient, for giving me this opportunity. Can we do three ohms one more time?
Yes.
Yes. Just do that. So close the eyes. We'll do three ohms. Inhale.